I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. 50 years ago today, just after 6 p.m. on April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. He was just 39 years old. He was in the city to support the striking sanitation workers and had delivered what turned out to be his final sermon, "I've Been to the Mountaintop," the night before at the Mason Temple. That same night, Senator Robert F. Kennedy was in Indianapolis, a stop on his presidential campaign, and told the shocked audience about King's death.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country in greater polarization. Black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand compassion and love.
We wanted to play that full clip to capture that moment, the words that Kennedy used, and the reaction from the crowd. A few months later, Kennedy was murdered. Today on Radio Times, how to remember Martin Luther King Jr., his life, his death, and his legacy. We have four guests who have joined us. Let me introduce the three of them that are sitting with us here in our Philadelphia studio. Reverend Charles L. Howard is the university chaplain at the University of Pennsylvania. His father knew Martin Luther King, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's an honor to be here with you.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us is Karen Asper Jordan. She's a Cecil B. Moore fighter, Philadelphia freedom fighter, and joins us along with her cohort here, Kenneth Salam, also known as Freedom Smitty. Karen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And Kenneth, nice to have you with us as well.
Thank you. Thank
You're
you.
Welcome. And joining us by Skype is Jason Sokol. He's Associate Professor of History at the University of New Hampshire. He's got a new book, The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Jason, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
That was a sad way to start the show, but it was such a sad moment, and certainly Kennedy delivering this sad and bad news to the crowd. And Karen, I was looking at you as you were listening to Kennedy. Where were you when you learned about King's death?
I was in the house. I didn't hear it on TV. I didn't have the TV on. And my nephew had come in and said, "You know that guy that you guys know?" And I said, "Who?" "King. He was killed." And I immediately, I couldn't believe it. I immediately went to our, we call it our clubhouse, our little stomping ground at Ridge and Girard. Mm-hmm. That's where we always met.
In Philly. Yep.
Yes, in Philadelphia, Green's Restaurant. And everybody was there by the time I got there. We were very devastated because he was a nonviolent man to be taken out so violently. And even though we did not agree with the nonviolence, because we were believed in self-defense. We were nonviolent people.
Right.
But we believed in self-defense. That was the difference. It hurt because it shouldn't have happened to him or anyone for that matter that's fighting for equality and justice for everyone.
How about for you, Kenneth?
Same. I had just gotten back from the South. You know, there were so many things going on in the 60s, and no one knew this was going to happen. So everybody didn't zero in on Memphis, you know. So I had just gotten back from Mississippi because I had been down there working along with Fannie Lou Hamer with voter registration. And I just came back to Philadelphia for a minute, and I was at home and watching television. That's how I heard it, you know. I couldn't believe it. And immediately, and we were freedom fighters. We didn't have any money. We lived off the people took care of us. So I went around with my hand out, quickly trying to get a plane ticket to get out of here, to leave Philly.
To go where?
To go back, to go down south, go to Atlanta, you know. And a young man, Mel Dorn, him and I, you know, people, some of the merchants in the area and some of the people collected a donation, and they bought us plane tickets, and we left that next morning to Atlanta. But it was just took my breath out of me. And it wasn't, I didn't cry. You know, it wasn't a boo-hoo. It was just inside. It was, here's a man whose whole effort was to bring attention to peace. And he was destroyed so violently, you know. Mm-hmm. And I had this philosophy very quickly. I believe when a person dies for the truth, their death blow isn't felt like a person who dies doing something evil. Mm. I really believe that, you know.
It lives on.
It lives on, you know. Mm. So I just, I know it was a shock to him, but I don't think he suffered, you know. I don't think he suffered in my heart, you know, and that's just my belief. But it was devastating to know that he is a guy, like you said, 39 years old.
Yeah, he was a young man.
Young man.
Chaz, your father knew him.
Yeah.
Knew him well.
They were in the same fraternity, Alpha Phi Alpha, and I think pulled together a friendship over the years. And my dad and my mom referenced Dr. King often. They were both lawyers, and they saw the work that they did as a different front in the fight for justice. I remember sitting in church with them when I was very young, and, you know, a lot of old black churches would have those fans that didn't have air conditioning, and very often on those fans, one side would have Dr. King's portrait on it. And to me, it was sort of a fan, and Dr. King was sort of a distant figure in American history, I think the greatest figure in American history, but I remember seeing them look at the fan a little longer, as if they were looking at a friend.
Hmm.
And to me, that look in their eyes is a bit of a compass. And you think about answering the question you ask, how should we commemorate this day? The look in their eyes pointed to both solemnity and conviction. And I think to me, that is how I'm holding this day. Solemnity at the great loss, at the illness that would kill a man like this. At conviction that we need to, as Dr. King did, put legs on our faith. In the same way that Karen and Freedom Smitty over here put legs on their faith and their beliefs too, I think. That is also the proper response today.
Let me go to you, Jason, and even go back to before King's death. And you write in the beginning of your book about the fact that most people in this country did not support him, that he was a divisive figure, that he was a controversial figure. Can you flesh that out for us?
Well, he was polarizing and controversial because, particularly in the last years of his life, he began to challenge white America, particularly whites in the North, in a way that hadn't been apparent earlier in his career. Many white liberals supported King's crusades in the South. Well, when he started to attack segregation in northern cities, when he started to speak up more forcefully against the Vietnam War, when he launched his Poor People's Campaign, that seemed more threatening to a segment of white America. And so He was a hated and reviled figure among some whites. I wouldn't go so far to say a majority of the country, but he was much more polarizing and controversial than I think a lot of people mm-hmm. realize today.
Is there a danger of sanitizing Dr. King, Jason?
Oh, of course. I mean, I think most people know King's I Have a Dream speech, and they know one line where he talked about when he longed for the day when his children would be judged not by the color of their skin but for the content of their character. But I think a lot of people don't know that in that same speech he talked about the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. He talked about the whirlwinds of revolt that would shake the nation if justice didn't come soon. So I think there's very much been a selective remembering and selective forgetting by a segment of white America in terms of how they've shaped King's legacy.
Do you think there's some truth to that, Karen?
Most definitely.
Most definitely.
Yes, because, you know, if you look at today and you think of the things that Dr. King had said back then, they hold true today. And now we have people that are warmongering, people that are openly showing their racist attitudes. It's quite different, and they're the things that he talked about, you know.
And also income inequality. I mean, that was also at the root of his
it's always message. Justice and equality. That's what the fight has always been about. Justice, equality, stopping police brutality, economic parity, the assault on the poor, which is going on still today, and it's getting worse.
Does that mean, if I can put this to you, Kenneth, does that mean that Martin Luther King's legacy is one of an inability of a country to live up to his words and his deeds?
Right. He challenged America. He was the conscience of America. And when he got beat, it hurt. Mm. It wasn't he got beaten. He just got some kind of charge out of it. But he believed in the goodness of the human nature and American social fiber, that maybe these people, we can touch something in their humanity that would say, stop it. Stop putting them dogs on the people. Stop hoarding hoes on the people. He really believed that. And in reference to him, you know, not changing, but people picking and choosing what part of Dr. King they want. But Dr. King started out, from what I saw personally, you know, he started out with a message to change the social behavior of America. And he knew that he was going up against a mountain. Mm. It wasn't no cakewalk. People forget his home was bombed while he was in it. Most people, if you bomb the average person's home, they're going to stop what they're doing.
Right.
But when you believe first in God, and you believe that what you are doing is right, because we were out there as teenagers, we really believed. We were beat, stomped on, kicked, but we really believed that people should not be judged by the color of their skin, something they have no control over.
Yes.
So Dr. King grew. He changed. Yes, he changed. We changed for the better because America was changing. And in New York very quickly, when he did his speech at the Vietnam, we were in New York at the Vietnam March, and when the New York Police Department attacked us with their horses, they came through the marches with their using their horses as weapons. And, you know, Dr. King talked about poverty. See, the Colonel Commission had just made his report in February.
You know what? Hold on that thought, only because we're up on a break here, and I don't want to interrupt you in talking about, certainly talking about the Kerner Commission. Well, we are talking about Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. He was assassinated 50 years ago today in 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee. He was there to support sanitation workers who were on strike. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with Jason Sokol. He joins us by Skype. He teaches at the University of New Hampshire, has a new book called The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Also with us and here in our Philadelphia studios is Reverend Charles L. Howard. He's the university chaplain at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us, Karen Asper Jordan and Kenneth Salam, also known as Freedom Smitty, and they're members of the Cecil B. Moore Philadelphia Freedom Fighters, and worked with Dr. King, certainly here in Philadelphia and in other parts of the country. I do want to play a speech that Dr. King gave to students at Barrett Junior High School in Philadelphia. This was October 26, 1967. This is when he talked about his What is Your Life's Blueprint, but this is a section where he reads a poem by Langston Hughes.
I close by quoting once more the man that the young lady quoted. That magnificent black bard who has now passed on, Langston Hughes. One day he wrote a poem entitled Mother to Son. The mother didn't always have her grammar right, but she uttered words of great symbolic profundity. Well, son, I'll tell you, life for me ain't been no crystal stad. It's had tacks in it, boards torn up, places with no carpet on the floor, bare. But all the time, I's been a-climbing on and reaching landings and turning corners and sometimes going in the dark where there ain't been no light. So, boy, don't you stop now. Don't you sit down on the steps because you finds this kind of hard. But I's still going, boy. I's still climbing. And life for me ain't been no crystal stair. Well, life for none of us has been a crystal stair. But we must keep moving. We must keep going. If you can't fly, run. If you can't run, walk. If you can't walk, crawl. But by all means, keep moving.
That man knew how to talk. What can I say? He knew how to deliver a speech, a sermon. We were all just hanging on every word there. Chaz, if I can go to you, you are a minister. How much did King's work influence you as a seminarian and now as a minister?
Tremendously. You know, I think it's an important point to remember that the soil from which Dr. King grew is sort of Christian scripture, is following this model of the radical Jesus Christ. This model that loves madly, that turns the other cheek, that is generous, that gives of oneself, that is sacrificial, and seeing that witness. I remember reading, you know, just taking a class on Dr. King while I was in seminary, and being convicted of that, and then coming back to Philadelphia and remembering that he studied here. He studied at seminary at Crozier here, takes classes at Penn with a philosopher there too, and deep Philadelphia connections. That if he could live a life that follows, that chases hard after a peaceful, world-changing Jesus, then hopefully all of our ministries, we thought together as seminarians, can reflect the same. Mm. And it's still benevolently haunting, this radical love. You know, the professor talked about that, you know, the way he was hated at the end of his life, the 70% disapproval rating, the threats that came in. And there's this little interview of Dr. King days before he's getting ready to die. Before he's killed, and he is asked about, what do you think about these threats coming in, and he describes them as our sick white brothers and sisters. And the sickness he talks about is the disease of racism and hate, but he called them brothers and sisters, which is profound. Still loving those who were years before calling and threatening his home in Montgomery, those who bombed his house, who hit him with a brick in Chicago, those who hated, still seeing them as brothers and sisters. That is, to me, deeply the Christian message, and convicting as a Christian minister myself.
Jason, if I can turn to you, and one of the things that you write in your book is this assassination exposed a virulent white racism. And clearly he was reviled by racists, white racists in this country. But explain what you mean there.
Well, I mean, thinking back from today, King is this revered, exalted hero, as he ought to be. We tend to assume that the moment of his assassination was therefore probably met with collective grief or felt as a national tragedy. What I found was there was a really diverse array of responses. And some white people thought King had it coming to him. They thought he had received his just desserts. They thought he was an agitator, a troublemaker. Of course, there were many millions who disagreed, who felt the loss profoundly, who felt their world shake and tremble. And there were many who worked for social justice in the wake of King's death. But we also need to remember that it was also a moment of coming apart, sad, you know, and there were politicians at the time, George Wallace, Spiro Agnew, Richard Nixon, who were happy to play into the anger in the society rather than try to bind up the wounds.
Karen, let me turn to you and to you, Kenneth, as well. And you grew up in Philadelphia, you live in Philadelphia, you were part of what I guess we could call the civil rights movement here in the city. Karen, what were the issues? What were the things that you and others were fighting for?
Justice,
equality. Justice, okay.
it's always justice and equality.
I got you.
But when I started, it was to desegregate Dry College. But we were inspired by what we had witnessed on TV. The hatred, the brutality, children, 5, 6 years old, along with women and men, being brutalized, being beaten, that did something to us. And it instilled in us something that we wanted to make a change and to do better and to make the world better. There's a saying that Mel Dorn, the head of our organization, the late Mel Dorn, he said, "We loved you before we knew you."
Uh-huh.
And when we were teenagers, we knew a lot of things we wouldn't be able to take advantage of. It wasn't in of us. We were too old for Dryad College. But we knew there were people coming behind us. Just as we came, other people thought of us before they knew us. Our forebearers, they believed, they loved us. And they knew they wouldn't be able to maybe escape enslavement. But all that they did for somebody else, for the future.
Well, and Girard College was a college or a school for white orphans.
Right.
But this was an important fight to have in Philadelphia.
Very, very important. And when we went to Girard College May 1st, 1965, well, 10 years prior to that, there had been some confrontations by the late Judge Raymond Pace Alexander and his team trying to get Girard College desegregated. But with so much legal language wrangling, it just died, you know. So in 1965, Cecil B. Moore, I was in the NAACP Youth Council. I got involved really real quickly. It's hard to talk about yourself. And when I use the term I always told people to picture a small I.
A small I as opposed to a capital I.
You know, really, because we didn't do this to be here. Okay, this is a surprise, and to be on your show. But anyway, I got involved when Medgar Evers was assassinated. He was one of the first civil rights leaders to be killed in America. And my father took me to City Hall, and it was a march around City Hall. And then I joined the NAACP, and when Girard College came, I was in high school. I was in the 11th grade. And I was I wanted to see that school desegregate so bad that I wanted to be there 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And I literally quit school. I quit high school.
To go protest.
To protest. And when I did go back,
even though you probably wouldn't have gone to that school, because
orphan. Like Karen said, I wasn't an orphan, right. You know, and I couldn't benefit from the results. But when you're concerned, it's not about ego; it's about we go, and that's what we were concerned about. We were concerned about the future. We know we couldn't go there. I changed myself, and me and Mel Dorn, head of our group, who's no longer with us, we went out to the post office at 35th Mark and chained our hands to the door. Handcuffed ourselves so they would get African American supervised. So Girard College was a center for African Americans in Philadelphia first to show their disgust about racism, at least in Philadelphia. And for 7 months and 17 days, 24 hours a day, right, we walked around those 40-some acres until those walls, as Dr. King said, when he came, will come tumbling down.
Which they did.
They did.
Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Kenneth Salam, also known as Freedom Smitty. He and Karen Asper Jordan are members of the Cecil B. Moore Philadelphia Freedom Fighters. Charles Howard is the university chaplain at the University of Pennsylvania. And joining us by Skype is Jason Sokol. He's an associate professor of history at the University of New Hampshire, author of a new book called The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times, as much of the country is talking about Martin Luther King Jr., who was assassinated 50 years ago today. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and tell us what this day means for you. Jason, let me go back to you, and your book also is about the numbers of riots, and I think in more than 100 cities after Dr. King was murdered. What were those riots in response to? Was it to his death, or were there other things at work?
Well, I mean, African Americans in many cities across the nation have been suffering from segregation, high rates of poverty, police brutality. So I think in a lot of these cities, the rage was already boiling, the rage at the oppression that that was directed toward them. Cities had certainly erupted in the summer of 1967. So I think a lot of these places were sort of ready to blow well before King's death. But King's death was sort of the match that lit the flame in many of these places. Washington, Chicago, Baltimore, Pittsburgh's experienced definitely the worst of the riots at that time.
How do you see those riots, Jess? Especially with King's talk of nonviolence.
You know, when people are upset, I see them feel a need to kind of scream. Or, you know, after something hurts them, they kind of grab a pillow and yell into that pillow because the pain is too much inside of them. It has to come out. I think that is true with what is described as rioting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's sort of portrayed oftentimes as people who are out of control and taking advantage of a situation and looting and so forth like that. But there's such a deep traumatic collective communal pain in so many of us that erupts. I think we saw that after Rodney King in L.A. I think we've seen so much of that during Black Lives Matter. After, you know, my hometown, I'm from Baltimore, after Freddie Gray was killed down there. All those spots I used to hang out down near the harbor and near the mall and spots like that. People weren't trying to just be bad. People were hurt. And that kind of collective scream and yell that enough is enough and we are tired of being, as they say, sick and tired of being sick and tired. So I understand it. I get it.
Karen, let me go to you and also to you, Kenneth, because in Philadelphia, there weren't the kind of riots that we saw in other cities. And some have credited Cecil B. Moore, Leon Sullivan, even Georgie Woods.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
That these
yes.
three people, for probably a whole host of reasons, were able to perhaps contain some of the upset that people felt. Can you speak to that?
They also understood the feeling of the people, and they were able to express that to the people, and the people respected it. Now, when Dr. King was assassinated, that was the last thing on my mind, to do something like that. Mm. And I don't think after the so-called riots on Columbia Avenue, nobody wanted to go through that because it was our communities that were destroyed.
And that was a couple of years earlier, right?
Yes.
On Columbia Avenue.
So no one wanted that. But we understood. He understood. Cecil understood. You know, Dr. Sullivan understood.
Did they say things or they had already kind of laid the groundwork?
Their works spoke for them. It preceded them. And when something like Dr. King, like in 1964, when the riots were on Columbia Avenue, I mean, Cecil was in Atlantic City, but he came back. But when he came back, he helped also. But Georgie Woods.
He had a radio show.
This guy had a radio show. You know, and he used his radio show. And that was the thing in the 60s. Whatever you had, so everybody can bring something to the table. Everybody's not going to be a Dr. King or Cecil B. Moore, but I couldn't be a Dr. King or Cecil B. Moore. All I was a body that wanted to show resistance to what was happening. So everybody has to feel that way, that everyone can do something, okay? So Georgie Woods and Cecil Moore and Dr. Sullivan already had an image of respect in the community. So when they said something, people trusted them. Because Cecil and Georgie Woods and Sullivan and others, they calmed that riot. Could have been worse in Philadelphia. And as Karen said, but we tore up our own community.
Yeah.
And we didn't want to do that again. And that's what that leads to.
Let me get Gary from, looks like Malvern, to join us on Radio Times. Gary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I was on the train. I was in the Air Force and in my uniform. Got on the train to Philly, and I'm going to D.C. because I was stationed at Boeing. And I had no idea what was happening, but that train was empty, and I went down there, and I saw fires in Baltimore from the distance. But when I got to Union Station, I couldn't believe it. They sent a military escort for me, so I knew it had to be bad. And when I tell people I saw this, and I saw it with my very eyes, they can't believe it. I saw machine guns on the Capitol steps of the Capitol, the west, when it was the east entrance at that point. I saw tanks going on Pennsylvania Avenue, and it was so sad. Because this is what I realize, and I might. That's what happens when you lose hope. Mm.
Gary, I appreciate your call and the feelings, obviously, in your call. And Jason, I wonder if you could speak to it. Again, you write about how a number of cities responded. And in D.C., I happened to be in college at the time in D.C., it was pretty devastating.
Yeah, I just want to echo what Reverend Howard and Freedom Smitty and Karen were saying, which is that King himself called riots the language of the unheard. I mean, he understood this disaffection and this despair and this hopelessness that drove a lot of this violence, and he tried to connect with it, and he faulted the federal government for failing to do enough. Just before he was killed, he had sent out this fundraising letter under SCLC, which said the government is playing Russian roulette with our cities and is courting another summer of disaster because it had not addressed any of the issues that were at the root of the riots. So King understood that, you know, he didn't necessarily fault the individuals who turned to violence, but he was faulting these broader problems that hadn't been addressed.
Well, let's take a very short break. I know you want to say something. We'll pick up on that after a short break. And today we are remembering Martin Luther King Jr., his life, his death, his legacy. We have four guests. You just heard Jason Sokol, author of a new book called The Heavens Might Crack. And with us in our Philadelphia studios, we've got Karen Jasper Jordan and Kenneth Salam Freedom Smitty. They're members of the Cecil B. Moore Philadelphia Freedom Fighters. Also with us, Reverend Charles Howard, University Chaplain at the University of Pennsylvania. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. What does this day mean to you? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us more after this short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with our guests about Martin Luther King Jr. He was assassinated, killed 50 years ago today. We've been playing clips, and this is from the recent March for Our Lives demonstration. And this is Yolanda Renee King, the granddaughter of Martin Luther King.
Granddaughter of Martin Luther King and Horace Scott King. His four little children will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream that enough is enough. And that this should be a gun-free world. Period. Will you please repeat these words after me? Spread the word!
I should add, she is 9 years old, just to kind of put all of that into some kind of context.
Future leader.
Future leader. Is that what you see?
Yes, definitely.
Children.
You know, definitely.
Well, I even wonder, I'll put this to you, Chaz, but you think of Black Lives Matter, you think of Me Too, you think of these young marchers for gun regulations and to deal with the spread of gun violence. Do you see that as a legacy of King?
Absolutely. You know, I the pen relays are coming up, my favorite time of the year. And the thing that's so moving about that is seeing people move the baton around the track and hand it off. And I think, you know, that who took the baton from Dr. King?
Yeah.
There's so many wonderful people whose names you could name. I think we're sitting with some of them right now. Individuals like Reverend Barber, Shane Claiborne, and others too. But I think the people who are really doing it are young people, mm-hmm. whether it's Dr. King's granddaughter, or the folks who were marching at Black Lives Matter or who were marching at March for Our Lives. My kids demanded that I take them downtown to be a part of Philly's March for Our Lives. They're making signs and yelling and screaming and taking pictures. And to me, that brings hope.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dr. King would be delighted that people are still fighting, that people are still dreaming and still working for freedom and justice.
Right. How do you see that, Renee? You're nodding your head.
Karen.
Sorry, Karen.
That's okay.
Why did I call you Renee?
I don't know. Maybe I look
I
Renee.
Took her middle name and gave
Renee.
It to you.
Yeah. You can call me Renee. I haven't called worse. But you look at children. We were children.
Yeah.
Something about children, they have that exuberance. When they believe something, they believe it. You're not going to take it from them. they know that they can make a difference because they believe. They have faith. They have hope.
Yes.
And it's the children that fuels everything. You need the adults. You need them to mentor the young because the young can't do it. Sometimes I won't follow young if, you know, there's no some kind of structure there.
Mm-hmm.
But the young people fuel every movement. That's what we did. And we were fearless.
And you were teenagers.
Yes. Mm. And we knew. And, you know, you're young. We didn't have a job. We weren't older. We had to worry about families to take care of. Some of us. Some of our people lost their homes, their families, because they were bitten by the freedom bug.
Mm.
You know, because they believed. You know, I lost my little job as a student tutor because I was arrested. You know, I went back to work and they said, oh, sorry, you have to go. Figure 16 years old, you know, working for the school district. But it didn't stop us. If we got arrested one day, we got out, we went back. We didn't care if we got arrested again.
We should sing a song. We should sing the freedom songs. And that's what we were really known for. I was known for leading a lot of the freedom songs. We all led, but that's how I got the name Freedom Smitty. Because I would take certain songs, take the situation and incorporate it into a song. And we should sing a song. We don't mind going to jail because Georgie Woods going to pay our bail.
That's so great.
And that's how it was. Yeah. That's how it was. You know, we went to jail. Right. We somebody should get us out.
Let me get Clay. He's been very patient hanging on from West Oak Lane. Clay, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. How is everyone?
I think we're okay. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. A couple of questions. I think you might have answered one partially already. I was going to ask, how do you think Dr. King would see the Black Lives Matter movement, and what do you think he would think of the Colin Kaepernick protest? Mm-hmm. And just one other thing. I don't want to monopolize the time, but if he had lived, where do you think his poor people's campaign would have gone?
Three big questions, three important ones as well. Clay, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jason, let me toss the first one to you, which is if it's possible to imagine how King would have thought about Black Lives Matter. But what are your thoughts?
Oh, yeah, I've written about this in some recent op-eds and also in the end of the book. I mean, the one thing among other things, the thing that King was committed to was nonviolent civil disobedience and massive civil disobedience. And King paralyzed cities day after day and week after week with street demonstrations. And so wherever King saw injustice festering, he thought it was the obligation of people to go and tie things up and to make life inconvenient until that injustice was dealt with. You know, the black athletes like Kaepernick, these guys are kneeling silently, peacefully on a football field, and a segment of white America is enraged. Well, that's nothing compared to what King did day after day and year after year. So King would be kneeling alongside the athletes. He'd be in the streets with the protesters, and I think that's undeniable.
What do you think, Chaz?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's no question Dr. King would have been in support of Black Lives Matter. He was critical of police violence during his life. I think he would have been critical of it right now as well. I think he'd be proud of the way people are dying in and disrupting and forcing people to listen and forcing people to wrestle with hard questions. I think similarly he would have supported Brother Kaepernick and others as well. I think the Poor People's Campaign, though, wildly unpopular.
Yes.
I mean, I think critiquing capitalism, you know, Dr. King himself moving more toward democratic socialism and other things like that, it's a dangerous game to play. I do think, though, he was a winner in a lot of ways. Yes. And I think that he would have fought to raise the minimum wage. I think he would have fought to sort of help with people who are on the street, people who are poor. I think he would have kept going with that. I think he would have gone to D.C. with the campaign and gotten arrested in a lot of ways that Reverend Barber and others are doing right now, too.
You know, I was thinking in putting the show together, and obviously in the introduction, we're talking about King, who was assassinated. Robert Kennedy killed a couple of months later, earlier in the 60s, of course, the death of the President Kennedy and of Malcolm X. And I think I'm going to call you by your correct name.
Okay.
I realized, you know what I did? I took the middle name of Martin Luther King's daughter and I gave it to you. But anyway,
that's all
Karen.
Right.
I hear young people today, you know, worry about our country, and there's much to worry about. I'm not diminishing that at all. And the old person that I am, I remember the 60s. I remember the 50s, what this country was like and how difficult it was. And obviously for King, this was years and years of protest and demonstration and speaking out to try to address these systemic problems in the United States. As you look back on the 60s, what are your thoughts?
It was a fun time.
There was that.
It wasn't all bad. And it was an exciting time. I had never met so many people. H. Rapp Brown, Stokely Carmichael, Julian Bond. We met all of the people. We were inspired by them. Cecil B. Moore, inspired by these folks. Walt Rosenbaum, who was this bail bondsman that got us out of jail. We were inspired. We had mentors. And we had people that we believed in, that valued us as people, valued us as civil rights demonstrators. Now, me personally, never was hungry. Always had food to eat. In spite of the demonstrations, I went to school, went to the prom, had parties, did all of those things. But in me, I knew that I had to make a difference. Mm-hmm. They called us picket line freaks.
Picket line freaks.
Because we demonstrated anywhere and everywhere. With Father Paul Washington, Operation Alert. We drove around in cars.
Church of the Advocate?
Yes. Yep. We'd meet there. We all get in cars, followed police looking for police brutality, slum landlords. All of these things we did in the hopes that it would make a better world for everyone. And Girard College wasn't the only demonstrations here in the city because we're still fighting for inclusion into unions. Strawberry Mansion High School, when they put the MSB building up, they did not have any black people working there, you know, as construction workers or anything. So it was always something, whether it was education, still fighting for that today, better schools, better education, still fighting for that today. And it's something from 1960, 50, 40, 30, we're still fighting for the same things, for parity, economic parity, like I said, employment opportunities, you know, post office that we demonstrate there. We did it all, and we're still fighting for the same things today.
The struggle continues, Kenneth?
Yes.
It continues, and, you know, I'm not the sharpest knife in the kitchen. But
pretty sharp, I'll just say.
No, but I've never seen any great change in history the old people did. I haven't read anything. When you look at the 60s, again, we were young. When you look at what's happening, to bringing attention and polarizing the country today, it is young people. Black Lives Matter. I don't know, when I saw people trying to demigrate or say, white lives matter, blue lives matter, police departments. You know, that's the whole premise of our movement in America, that to tell America, racism in America, that we matter. We just happen to be black.
Yes, sir.
And what Black Lives Matter did, all they did was simply write it on a sign. We've always been saying, our lives matter. So when they put it on the sign, now everybody said, what is this Black Lives Matter? But in reference to the Poor People's March, that was a tactic. It's just another tactic. You know, Dr. King said, I was around Stokely, I was around SNCC, I was around CORE, and I saw the tension. And as I grew as an adult, I understood that this racism in America is systemic. It's like a bear. You can't bring a bear down with one grab. Mm-hmm. Dr. King grabbed him. Malcolm grabbed him. Floyd McKissick grabbed him. Stokely grabbed him. And we're trying to bring, there's no one silver bullet. And so I never pitch one against the other like the press would do, or some of them in their organizations. But when I saw those young people last March 24th, and I almost wanted to cry because something's going to happen now.
Because they're
young people are, and they're smarter than us.
Yes.
They got telephones, they got internet. And we had was copy machines and word of the mouth.
Yep.
So I'm optimistic. I think there's going to be a total different look in America in the next 25
Amen.
Years.
You're optimistic too, Chaz?
Absolutely. I'm optimistic. and I think we have to be. We have to be a people of hope, a people of faith, people who believe change is coming. I think Dr. King was optimistic. He was certainly practical and realist, but I'm optimistic. I'm aware today, too. I'm 39. I'm the exact same age that Dr. King was when he died. And those of us who have our lives right now, I think we must not only be optimistic, but we must act because we are here. And I think King would want us to further his legacy.
Jason, are you optimistic?
I'm generally by nature optimistic about, you know, about America, even though I've written all these books that detail America's rather grim history.
That's why I asked you, yes.
But there's a couple different things going on right now. On the one hand, white supremacists feel empowered and emboldened because of who's in the White House and the old Oval Office, and that's much, much less hopeful than it was a few years ago. On the other hand, we have seen these wonderful peaceful mass demonstrations from the Women's March, the March for Our Lives, which shows that a broad cross section of Americans aren't going to sit there idly and allow our country to be befouled by the vile racism and lies that inhabit the Oval Office.
Well, we're almost out of time. We're going to close things out with the very end of the mountaintop speech. And Chaz, if I can just turn to you, there's much in the speech, and I think we're most familiar with the end. But nonetheless, what do you hear in 30 seconds or less? What do you hear in this speech?
I hear a man who knows we're going to win, that we win in the end, and that we shouldn't be afraid. There's a line in here where he talks about, I'm not fearing anyone. I'm not fearing any man. And to me, that's echoing with me right now, that there's a lot to be afraid of from D.C. and all around the world, but we should go on without fear.
Even though much has been said about the end, that he sees his own death, but the speech is so much more than that.
I may not get there with you, but we'll get to there as a promised land, as a people.
Well, my thanks to all four of you for joining us. Jason Sokol, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. Chaz Howard, thank you for joining us as well. Karen, Jesper Jordan, thank you for coming in. And Kenneth Salam, Freedom Smitty, thank you for coming in and for your
You're
work
welcome.
As
thank
well.
Thank you for what you do.
Thank you for what you do. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And we do close things out with King's last speech. I have been to the mountaintop.
Some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. Yeah. What would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers? Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.